Chapter 3. Maps of the Psyche in Depth Psychology. Toward an Integration of Approaches. Part 2.
We thus should not be surprised by the scandals in the highest social and political circles, such as the affair of John Profumo, Secretary of State for War, with Christine Keeler, which shook the British Parliament and discredited the Conservative Party. The escapades of Ted Kennedy that destroyed his chances for presidency, John Kennedy's naked swimming parties and sexual peccadilloes that threatened national security, Anthony Weiner's multiple sex scandals and pornographic sexting, and Bill Clinton's sexual extravaganzas that for many months paralyzed the U.S. government. The deep roots of sexual pathology, Krafft-Ebing's Psychopathia Sexualis, can be found in the third perinatal matrix, where strong libidinal arousal is associated with anxiety, pain, aggression, and the encounter with biological material. Feelings of inadequacy, inferiority, and low self-esteem can be traced beyond the biographical conditioning in early childhood to the helplessness of the fetus in the life-threatening and overpowering situation of birth. Both Freud and Adler, because of an insufficient depth of their approach, focused selectively on two categories of psychological forces that, on a deeper level, represent two facets of the same process. The awareness of death, the crucial theme of the perinatal process, had a powerful impact on both researchers. Freud postulated in his final theoretical formulations the existence of the death instinct, thanatos, as an important force in the psyche. His biological emphasis prevented him from seeing the possibility of the psychological transcendence of death, and he created a gloomy and pessimistic image of human existence. The theme of death also played an important role in his personal life, since he suffered from severe thanatophobia. Adler's life and work were also very strongly influenced by the problem of death. He saw the inability to prevent and control death as being the core of feelings of inadequacy. It is interesting that Adler was aware that his decision to become a physician, a member of the profession trying to control and conquer death, was deeply influenced by his near-death experience at the age of 5. It is likely that the same factor also functioned as a prism that shaped his theoretical speculations. From observations arising from deep experiential therapy, the determined striving for external goals and the pursuit of success do very little in overcoming feelings of inadequacy and low self-esteem, no matter the outcome of these endeavors. The feelings of inferiority cannot be resolved by mobilizing one's forces to overcompensate them, but by confronting them experientially and surrendering to them. They are then consumed in the process of ego death and rebirth, and a new self-image emerges from the awareness of one's cosmic identity. True courage lies in the willingness to undergo this awesome process of inner transformation, not in a heroic pursuit of external goals. Unless the individual succeeds in finding his or her true identity within, any attempts to give their life meaning by striving for external achievement will be a futile and ultimately self-defeating, quixotic crusade. Wilhelm Reich. Another important psychoanalytic renegade was the Austrian psychiatrist and political activist Wilhelm Reich. Maintaining Freud's main thesis concerning the paramount importance of sexual factors in the etiology of neuroses, he modified Freud's concepts substantially by emphasizing sex economy. The balance between energy charge and discharge, or sexual excitement and release. According to Reich, the suppression of sexual feelings, together with the characterological attitude that accompanies it, constitutes the true neurosis. The clinical symptoms are only its overt manifestations. The emotional traumas and sexual feelings are held in repression by complex patterns of chronic muscular tensions, the character armor. The term armoring refers to the function of protecting the individual against painful and threatening experiences from without and within. For Reich, the critical factor that contributes to incomplete sexual orgasm and congestion of bioenergy is the repressive influence of society. A neurotic individual maintains balance by binding his excess energy in muscular tensions and thus limiting sexual excitement. A healthy individual does not have such a limitation. His or her energy is not bound in muscular armoring and can flow freely. Reich's contribution to therapy is of great significance and lasting value. His dissatisfaction with the methods of psychoanalysis led him to the development of a system called character analysis, and later, character analytic vegetotherapy. It was a radical departure from classical Freudian techniques because it concentrated on the treatment of neuroses from a biophysical point of view and involved physiological elements. Reich used hyperventilation, a variety of body manipulations, and direct physical contact to mobilize the jammed energies and remove the blocks. Reich's therapeutic experiments inspired the revolutionary experiential and physical therapies of the 1960s, many of which have been referred to as Neo-Reichian. Alexander Lowen's bioenergetics, John Pierrico's core energetics, Charles Kelly's radix therapy, Stanley Kellerman's formative psychology, Arthur Janov's primal therapy, and others. According to Reich, the goal of therapy was to ensure the patient was capable of fully surrendering to the spontaneous and involuntary movements of the body that are normally associated with the respiratory process. If this was accomplished, the respiratory waves produced an undulating movement in the body that Reich called the orgasm reflex. He believed that those patients who achieve it in therapy are then capable of surrendering fully in the sexual situation, reaching a state of total satisfaction. The full orgasm discharges all the excess energy of the organism, and the patient remains free of symptoms. As he was developing his theories and trying to implement his ideas, Reich became increasingly controversial. Seeing the repressive role of society as one of the main factors in emotional disorders, he combined his innovative work in psychotherapy with radical political activity as a member of the Communist Party. This eventually ended in his break with both the psychoanalytic circles and the communist movement. After Reich's conflict with Freud, his name was dropped from the roster of the International Psychoanalytic Association. The publication of his politically explosive book, Mass Psychology of Fascism, in which he described the Nazi movement as a social pathology caused by the repression of sexuality, led to his excommunication from the Communist Party. In later years, Reich became increasingly convinced of the existence of primordial cosmic energy that is the source of three large realms of existence, which arise through a complicated process of differentiation: mechanical energy, inorganic mass, and living matter. This energy that Reich called orgone could be demonstrated visually, thermally, electroscopically, and by the means of Geiger-Müller counters. It was different from electromagnetic energy, and one of its main properties was pulsation. According to Reich, the dynamics of orgone and the relationship between mass-free orgone energy and orgone energy that has become matter is essential for any true functional understanding of the universe, nature, and the human psyche. The streaming of orgone and its dynamic superimpositions can explain such diverse phenomena as the creation of subatomic particles, tornadoes, the aurora borealis, and the formation of galaxies, as well as the origin of life forms, growth, locomotion, sexual activity and the reproductive processes, and psychological phenomena. Reich designed special orgone accumulators, boxes that, according to him, collected and concentrated orgone for therapeutic use. He sent one of the devices to Albert Einstein, who spent 5 days studying it before he declared the orgone theory to be an illusion and tried to dissuade Reich from pursuing it. Orgone therapy was based on the assumption that the body and the psyche are both rooted bioenergetically in the pulsating pleasure system, blood and vegetative apparatus, as the common source of psychological and somatic functions. Orgone therapy was, therefore, not a psychological but rather a biological therapy, dealing with disturbances of pulsation in the autonomic system. Wilhelm Reich's work, which began originally as highly innovative therapeutic experimentation, moved gradually into increasingly remote areas: physics, biology, cellular biopathy, abiogenesis, meteorology, astronomy, extraterrestrial visitations, and philosophical speculations. The end of his stormy scientific career was tragic. Since he used and advocated for the use of orgone generators, which were denounced by the Food and Drug Administration, he got into serious conflicts with the U.S. government. After much harassment, he was twice imprisoned and finally died in jail from a heart attack. From the point of view of the concepts presented in this encyclopedia, Reich's major contribution seems to be in the areas of bioenergetic processes and the psychosomatic correlations in the genesis of emotional disorders and in their therapy. Reich was fully aware of the enormous blocked energies underlying neurotic symptoms and of the futility of purely verbal approaches to therapy. Also, his understanding of armoring and the role of musculature in neuroses is a contribution of lasting value. The observations from LSD work confirm the basic Reichian concepts of energetic blockages and the involvement of the muscular and the vegetative systems in neuroses. A patient's experiential confrontation with his or her emotional symptoms is typically accompanied by intense tremors, shaking, jerks, contortions, the prolonged maintaining of extreme postures, grimacing, uttering sounds, and even occasionally vomiting. It is quite clear that dramatic physiological manifestations and psychological aspects of this process, such as perceptual, emotional, and ideational manifestations, are intimately interconnected, representing two sides of the same coin. The basic difference between my own point of view and the Reichian theory lies in the interpretation of this process. Wilhelm Reich put great emphasis on the gradual accumulation and congestion of sexual energy in the organism due to societal influences, interference with full sexual orgasm. As a result of repeated incomplete discharge, the libido jams in the organism and finally finds deviant expressions in a variety of psychopathological phenomena, from psychoneuroses to perversions and sadomasochism. Effective therapy, then, requires a release of pent-up libidinal energies, dissolution of the body armor, and achievement of total orgasm. The observations from the work with holotropic states support Reich's concept of the body armor, but indicate clearly that this energetic reservoir is not a consequence of chronic sexual stasis resulting from incomplete orgasms. Much of the energy released during experiential psychotherapy turns out to be the result of the hours of excessive neuronal excitation triggered by the stress, pain, fear, and suffocation experienced during the passage through the birth canal. The deepest basis of much of the character armor seems to be in the introjected dynamic conflicts between the excessive neuronal overstimulation caused by the birth process and the unrelenting straitjacket of the birth canal, preventing adequate emotional and physical response and peripheral discharge. The dissolution of the armor coincides to a great extent with the completion of the death-rebirth process. However, some of its elements have even deeper roots in the transpersonal realms. Perinatal energy can be easily mistaken for jammed libido because BPM-3 has a substantial sexual component, and due to the similarity between the pattern of the sexual orgasm and the birth orgasm. Activated perinatal energy seeks peripheral discharge, and the genitals represent one of the most logical and important channels. This seems to form the basis for a vicious circle. The aggression, fear, and guilt associated with the third perinatal matrix interfere with full orgastic ability, and conversely, the absence or incompleteness of sexual orgasm blocks an important safety valve for the birth energies. The situation is thus the opposite of what Reich postulated. It is not that societal and psychological factors interfering with full orgasm lead to the accumulation and stasis of sexual energy, but that deep-seated perinatal energies interfere with adequate orgasm and, at the same time, create psychological and interpersonal problems. To rectify this situation, these powerful energies must be discharged in a non-sexual, therapeutic context and reduced to a level that the patient and the partner can comfortably handle in a sexual interaction. Many phenomena discussed by Reich, from sadomasochism to the mass psychopathology of fascism, can be explained more adequately from perinatal dynamics than from incomplete orgasm and the jamming of sexual energy. Reich's speculations, although unconventional and at times undisciplined, are in their essence often compatible with modern developments in science. In his understanding of nature, he came close to the worldview suggested by quantum relativistic physics, emphasizing the unity underlying the world, focusing on process and movement rather than substance and solid structure, and acknowledging the active role of the observer. Reich's ideas about the joint origin of inorganic matter, life, consciousness, and knowledge are at times reminiscent of the philosophical speculations of David Bohm and Irvin Laszlo. His arguments against the universal validity of the principle of entropy and the second law of thermodynamics resemble the conclusions of Ilya Prigogine's careful and systematic research into dissipative structures and order out of chaos. In the field of psychology, Reich came close, both theoretically and practically, to the discovery of the perinatal realm of the unconscious. His work on muscular armoring, his discussion of the dangers of sudden removal of the armor, and his concept of total orgasm clearly involve important elements of perinatal dynamics. However, he showed determined resistance to its most critical elements, the psychological significance of the experiences of birth and death. This is evident from his passionate defense of the primary role of genitality and his rejection of Otto Rank's concept of the birth trauma, Sigmund Freud's speculations about death, and Carl Abraham's assumptions of a psychological need for punishment. In many ways, Reich also teetered on the edge of mysticism and transpersonal psychology. He was obviously close to the concept of cosmic consciousness and mystical awareness, which found its expression in his speculations about the orgone. True religion, for him, was unarmored, oceanic merging with the dynamics of the universal orgone energy. However, in sharp contrast with perennial philosophy, Reich's understanding of this cosmic energy was quite concrete. Orgone was measurable and had specific physical characteristics. Reich never reached a true understanding and appreciation of the great spiritual philosophies of the world. In his passionate critical excursions against spirituality and religion, he tended to confuse mysticism with certain superficial and distorted versions of mainstream religious doctrines. In his polemics, he argued against the literal belief in devils with tails and pitchforks, winged angels, formless blue-gray ghosts, dangerous monsters, heavens, and hells. He then discounted these as projections of unnatural, distorted organ sensations, and in the last analysis, as misperceptions of the universal flow of the orgone energy. Similarly, Reich was also strongly opposed to Jung's interest in mysticism and his tendency to spiritualize psychology. For Reich, mystical inclinations reflected armoring and a serious distortion of orgone economy. The mystical search, then, could be reduced to misunderstood biological urges. Thus, fear of death and dying is identical with unconscious orgasm anxiety and the alleged death instinct, the longing for disintegration. For nothingness is the unconscious longing for the orgastic resolution of tension. He also said, God is the representation of the natural life forces, of the bioenergy in man, and is nowhere so clearly expressed as in the sexual orgasm. Devil, then, is the representation for the armoring that leads to perversion and distortion of these life forces. In direct contrast with psychedelic observations, Reich claimed that the mystical tendencies disappear if therapy succeeds in dissolving the armor. In his opinion, orgastic potency is not found among mystics any more than mysticism is found among the orgastically potent. Otto Rank. Otto Rank's major areas of disagreement with Freud were his emphasis on the paramount significance of the birth trauma as compared to sexual dynamics, negation of the crucial role of the Oedipus complex, and his concept of ego as an autonomous representative of the will rather than a slave of the id. Rank also offered modifications of the psychoanalytic technique that were as radical as his theoretical contributions. He suggested that a verbal approach to psychotherapy is of limited value and that the main emphasis in therapeutic work should be on experience. According to Rank, it was essential for the patient to relive the trauma of birth in therapy. Without it, treatment should not be considered complete. He actually gave his clients the date when psychoanalysis would end, and believed that coming close to this date would activate their unconscious material related to birth and bring it to the threshold of consciousness. As far as the role of birth trauma in psychology is concerned, Freud was actually the first one to draw attention to the possibility that the fear associated with the sensations and innervations during the challenging passage through the birth canal might be the prototype and source of all future anxieties. This idea came to him when he was observing the obstetric nurse's medical examinations. One of the questions during the exam was, when and why does meconium, fetal feces, appear during birth? The correct answer would have been that it indicates a high degree of suffocation for the fetus. The nurse's answer was, because the fetus is scared shitless, thus putting the emphasis on the effect of fear on the anal sphincter. The nurse did not pass the examination, but Freud took the reference to fear in connection to birth seriously. He thought about the linguistic similarity that exists in some languages between the words for fear and a narrow space, such as angustie, narrow canyon, and anxietus, fear in Latin, and eng, narrow, and angst, anxiety, in German. In Czech, the word úzkost literally means both narrowness and anxiety. It is also well known that soldiers experiencing extreme fear in battles sometimes lose control over the anal sphincter and soil their pants. Freud discussed this issue in several of his writings, but did not pursue it any further. Otto Rank became captivated by this idea and worked secretly on the book The Trauma of Birth. He gave the finished work to Freud as a birthday gift, fresh from the press. Freud's principal biographer, Ernest Jones, said that after reading this book, Freud went into a state of emotional shock that lasted 4 months. His reaction was not an expression of criticism and anger about what Runk had written. As a matter of fact, it was exactly the opposite. He was afraid that future generations would see Runk's theory as more important than his own discovery of psychoanalysis. Freud was very sensitive to this because he had narrowly missed out on obtaining scientific priority for discovering the anesthetic properties of cocaine and its importance for medicine. This distinction went to his Viennese colleague Karl Kohler. Once he recovered from his shock over Rank's book, Freud wrote a fair report about it. He referred to the book as a very important contribution to psychoanalytic theory, second in its importance only to his discovery of psychoanalysis. He suggested that analysts should study the people born by cesarean section and compare them with those who had normal and difficult births to see what differences they could find. Later, Freud received letters from Berlin's influential psychoanalyst Carl Abraham and others, warning him that Rank's book would destroy the homogeneity of the psychoanalytic movement. They suggested that some of the members would enthusiastically embrace Rank's theory, and others would reject it and refuse to accept Rank's extreme formulations. Freud yielded to the pressure, and the resulting conflict between him and Rank led to the termination of Rank's membership in the Psychoanalytic Association. There was a major difference, though, between the concept of the birth trauma as seen by Freud and Rank. Holotropic research showed that during the short time that Freud thought about the trauma of birth, his understanding of birth was actually more accurate than Rank's. While Freud emphasized the extreme physiological challenges involved in the passage through the birth canal, Rank put more emphasis on losing the comfort of the maternal womb as a paradisian situation of unconditional and effortless gratification and having to face the challenges of postnatal life. Rank saw the trauma of birth as the ultimate reason why separation is the most painful and frightening human experience. According to him, all later frustrations of partial drives can be seen as derivatives of this primal trauma. Most of the events experienced by the individual as traumatic derive their pathogenic power from their similarity to biological birth. The entire period of childhood can be seen as a series of attempts at abreacting and psychologically mastering this fundamental trauma. Infantile sexuality can be reinterpreted as the child's desire to return to the womb, the anxiety associated with it, and curiosity about where he or she came from. Ranke did not stop here, though. He believed that the mental life of humans has its origin in the primal anxiety and primal repression precipitated by the birth trauma. The central human conflict consists of the desire to return to the womb and the fear of this wish. As a result of it, any change from a pleasurable situation to an unpleasant one will give rise to feelings of anxiety. Ranke also offered an alternative to the Freudian interpretation of dreams. Sleep is a condition that resembles the intrauterine life, and dreams can be understood as attempts to relive the birth trauma and return to the prenatal state. Even more than the act of sleep itself, they represent a psychological return to the womb. The analysis of dreams provides the strongest support for the psychological significance of the birth trauma. Similarly, Ranke also reinterpreted the cornerstone of Freudian theory, the Oedipus complex, by putting emphasis on the trauma of birth and the desire to return to the womb. According to him, the core of the Oedipus myth is the mystery of the origin of man, which Oedipus tries to solve by returning to the mother's womb. This happens not only literally in the act of marriage and sexual union with his mother, but also symbolically through his blindness and disappearance into the cleft rock leading into the underworld. In Rankean psychology, the birth trauma also plays a crucial role in sexuality. Its importance is based on the deep desire to return to the intrauterine existence that governs the human psyche. According to him, much of the difference between the sexes can be explained by women's ability to replay the reproductive process through their bodies and find their immortality in procreation. Whereas for men, sex represents mortality, and their strength lies in non-sexual creativity, such as technology, science, painting, music, and literature. Interestingly, males who explore the perinatal layer of their psyche can at times develop feelings of womb envy, in sharp contrast with Freud's focus on penis envy. Analyzing human culture, Ranke found the birth trauma to be a powerful psychological force behind religion, art, and history. Every form of religion ultimately tends toward the reinstitution of the original succoring and protective situation of the womb. The deepest root of art is the autoplastic imitation of one's own origin and growth from the maternal vessel. Art, being a representation of reality and at the same time a denial of it, is a particularly powerful means of coping with the primal trauma. The history of human dwellings, from the search for primitive shelters to elaborate architectural structures, reflects instinctive memories of the warm, protective womb. The use of implements and weapons is, in the last analysis, based on an insatiable tendency to force one's way completely into the mother. LSD psychotherapy and other forms of deep experiential work have brought strong support for Ranke's general thesis about the paramount psychological significance of the birth trauma. However, substantial modifications of the Rankean approach are necessary to increase its compatibility with actual clinical observations. As I mentioned earlier, Rank's theory focuses on the problem of separation from the mother and loss of the womb as the essential traumatic aspects of birth. For him, the trauma consists of the fact that the postnatal situation is far less favorable than the prenatal one. Outside the womb, the child has to face the irregularity of the food supply, the absence of the mother, oscillations of temperature, and loud noises. He or she has to breathe, swallow food, and dispose of waste products. In the work with holotropic states, the situation appears much more complicated. Birth is not traumatic just because the child is transferred from the paradise situation in the womb into the adverse conditions of the external world. The passage through the birth canal itself entails enormous emotional and physical stress and pain. This was emphasized in Freud's original speculations about birth, but almost entirely neglected by Rank. In a sense, Rank's concept of the birth trauma applied more to the situation of a person born by elective cesarean section than to vaginal childbirth. Most of the psychopathological conditions are rooted in the dynamics of BPM-2 and BPM-3, which reflects the challenges experienced during the hours spent in the birth canal between the undisturbed intrauterine state and the postnatal existence in the external world. The impulse to exteriorize and discharge the pent-up feelings and energies generated during the birth struggle represents a deep motivational force for a broad spectrum of human behaviors. Like Freud, Adler, and Reich, Rank also did not have a genuine understanding of the transpersonal realms. He saw religious and mythological motifs and figures as derivatives of the trauma of birth. For example, the crucified body of Jesus represented the polar opposite of the comfortable and relaxed body of the fetus in the womb. And the images of terrifying female goddesses, such as Hecate or Medusa, were inspired by the anxiety experienced during birth. In spite of these shortcomings, Rank's discovery of the psychological importance of the birth trauma and its many ramifications was a truly remarkable achievement that preceded, by many decades, the confirmations of his findings in LSD psychotherapy. It is astonishing that 100 years later, mainstream psychiatric academics and clinicians still refuse to accept that birth is a major psychotrauma, in spite of overwhelming evidence from experiential therapies. We should mention that several other psychoanalysts also recognize the significance of various aspects of the birth trauma. Nandor Fodor, in his pioneering book The Search for the Beloved, described in considerable detail the relations between various facets of the birth process and many important psychopathological symptoms in a way that has extensive congruence with the LSD observations. Lietart Pierbolte wrote a comprehensive book, Prenatal Dynamics, in which he discussed his unique insights into the psychological relevance of prenatal existence and the birth experience. This topic also received a great deal of attention in the work of Frank Lake, and an original and imaginative, although more speculative and less clinically grounded, books by Francis Mott. Carl Gustav Jung. The list of famous psychoanalytic renegades would not be complete without Carl Gustav Jung, who was initially one of Freud's favorite disciples and the designated crown prince of psychoanalysis. Jung's revisions were by far the most radical, and his contributions were truly revolutionary. It is not an exaggeration to say that his work moved psychiatry as far beyond Freud as Freud's discoveries were ahead of his own time. Jung's analytical psychology is not just a variety or modification of psychoanalysis. It represents an entirely new concept of depth psychology and psychotherapy. Jung was well aware that his findings could not be reconciled with Cartesian-Newtonian thinking, and that they required a drastic revision of the most fundamental philosophical assumptions of Western science. He was deeply interested in the revolutionary developments of quantum relativistic physics and had fruitful exchanges with some of its founders, including Wolfgang Pauli and Albert Einstein. Unlike the rest of the theoreticians of psychoanalysis, Jung also had a genuine understanding of the mystical traditions and a great respect for the spiritual dimensions of the psyche and of human existence. Jung was the first transpersonal psychologist, although he didn't call himself one. Jung can also be considered the first modern psychologist. The differences between Freudian psychoanalysis and Jung's analytical psychology are representative of the differences between classical and modern psychotherapy. Although Freud and some of his followers proposed rather radical revisions of Western psychology, only Jung challenged its very core and its philosophical foundations, monistic materialism, and the Cartesian-Newtonian paradigm. As June Singer so clearly pointed out, he stressed the importance of the unconscious rather than of consciousness, the mysterious rather than the known, the mystical rather than the scientific, the creative rather than the productive, and the religious rather than the profane. Jung's concept of the human psyche represented a major expansion beyond Freud's biographical model. His radical departure from Freud's psychoanalysis started when he was analyzing a collection of poetry and prose by the American writer Miss Frank Miller, which was published in Geneva by Theodore Flournoy and became known as the Miller Fantasies. He discovered that many motifs in her writing had parallels in the literature of various countries around the world, as well as different historical periods. His book, Symbols of Transformation, inspired by this research, is a work of major historical importance as a landmark of his break with Freud. These observations were further confirmed through the analysis of patients' dreams, fantasies, and the hallucinations and delusions of his schizophrenic patients, along with his own dream life. This convinced him that we do not have only the Freudian individual unconscious, a psychobiological junkyard of rejected instinctual tendencies, repressed memories, and subconsciously assimilated prohibitions, but also a collective unconscious, the manifestation of an intelligent and creative cosmic force, which binds us to all humanity, nature, and the entire cosmos. Jung's collective unconscious has a historical domain, which contains the entire history of humanity, and the archetypal domain, which harbors the cultural heritage of mankind, mythologies from every culture that has ever existed. In holotropic states of consciousness, we can experience visions of characters and scenes from these mythologies, even if we do not have any previous intellectual knowledge of them. Exploring the collective unconscious, Jung discovered universal principles governing the dynamics of this domain of the psyche. He first referred to them as primordial images, using a term that he borrowed from Jakob Burckhardt. Later, he called them dominants of the collective unconscious, and finally, archetypes. According to the understanding that has emerged from Jungian psychology, consciousness research, and scholarly mythological research, archetypes are timeless, primordial cosmic principles underlying and informing the fabric of the material world. Jung put great emphasis on the unconscious and its dynamics, but his concept of it was radically different from Freud's. Jung did not see the human being as a biological machine. He recognized that humans can transcend the narrow boundaries of their egos and of the personal unconscious, and connect with the self that is commensurate with the entire cosmos. Jung saw the psyche as a complementary interplay between its conscious and unconscious elements, with a constant energy exchange and flow between the two. According to him, the unconscious is not governed by historical determinism alone, but also has a projective, finalistic, teleological function. The self has a specific goal or purpose for each of us and can guide us to it. Jung referred to this as the individuation process. Studying the specific dynamics of the unconscious through the association experiment, Jung discovered its functional units, for which he coined the term complexes. Complexes are constellations of psychological elements, ideas, opinions, attitudes, and convictions that are clustered around a nuclear theme and associated with distinct feelings. Jung was able to trace complexes from biographically determined motifs to archetypes of the collective unconscious. In his early work, Jung saw a similarity between archetypes and animal instincts, and thought that they were hardwired in the human brain. Later on, while studying instances of extraordinary coincidences, such as dreams or visions, with events in the external world, synchronicities, he concluded that the archetypes must be in some way influencing the very fabric of the world, as they seem to represent a link between matter and psyche or consciousness. He referred to them as psychoids, borrowing a term coined by the founder of Vitalism, Hans Driesch. Comparative religion and world mythology can be seen as unique sources of information about the collective aspects of the unconscious. According to Freud, myths can be interpreted in terms of the characteristic problems and conflicts of childhood, and their universality reflects the commonality of human experience. Jung found this explanation unacceptable. He repeatedly observed that the universal mythological motifs, mythologems, occurred in individuals for whom all intellectual knowledge of this kind was absolutely out of the question. This suggested to him that there were myth-forming structural elements in the unconscious psyche that gave rise both to the fantasy lives and dreams of individuals and to the mythology of peoples. Dreams can thus be seen as individual myths, and myths as collective dreams. Freud showed a very deep interest in religion and spirituality throughout his life. He believed that it was possible to get a rational grasp of the irrational processes and tended to interpret religion in terms of unresolved conflicts from the infantile stage of psychosexual development. In contrast to Freud, Jung was willing to accept the irrational, paradoxical, and even mysterious. He had many religious experiences during his lifetime that convinced him of the reality of the spiritual dimension in the universal scheme of things. Jung's basic assumption was that the spiritual element is an organic and integral part of the psyche. Genuine spirituality is an aspect of the collective unconscious and is independent of childhood programming and the individual's cultural or educational background. Thus, if self-exploration and self-analysis reach sufficient depth, spiritual elements emerge spontaneously into consciousness. Jung also differed from Freud in his understanding of the central concept of psychoanalysis, that of the libido. He did not see it as a strictly biological force aiming for mechanical discharge, but as a creative force of nature, a cosmic principle comparable to Aristotle's entelechy or Henri Bergson's élan vital. Jung's genuine appreciation of spirituality and his understanding of libido as a cosmic force found their expression in a unique concept regarding the function of symbols. For Freud, a symbol was an analogous expression of, or allusion to, something already known. Its function was comparable to that of a traffic sign. In psychoanalysis, one image is used instead of another one, usually of a forbidden sexual nature. Jung disagreed with this use of the term symbol and referred to Freudian symbols as signs. For him, a true symbol points beyond itself into a higher level of consciousness. It is the best possible formulation of something that is unknown, an archetype that cannot be represented more clearly or specifically. What truly makes Jung the first modern psychologist is his scientific method. Freud's approach was strictly historical and deterministic. He was interested in finding rational explanations for all psychic phenomena and tracing them back to biological roots, following the chains of linear causality. Jung was aware that linear causality is not the only mandatory connecting principle in nature. He originated the concept of synchronicity, an acausal connecting principle that refers to meaningful coincidences of events separated in time and/or space. Jung's willingness to enter the realm of the paradoxical, mysterious, and ineffable also included an open-minded attitude toward the great Eastern spiritual philosophies. He studied and commented on the I Ching, Bardo Todol, Secret of the Golden Flower, and Awakening of Kundalini. Among his esoteric interests were also astrology, mediumship, and other psychic phenomena. The observations from psychedelic experiences and other types of holotropic states of consciousness have repeatedly confirmed most of Jung's brilliant insights. Although even Jung's analytical psychology does not adequately cover the entire spectrum of phenomena occurring in holotropic states, it requires the least revisions or modifications of all the schools of depth psychology. On the biographical level, Jung's description of psychological complexes bears some similarity to coex systems, although the two concepts are not identical. Jung and his followers were aware of the importance of the death-rebirth process in mythology and studied its various forms from ancient Greek mysteries to the rites of passage of aboriginal cultures. However, Jung was not able to see the close connection between this process and biological birth. Jung, who discovered and described the vast domains of the historical and archetypal collective unconscious, was not able to accept that birth is a psychotrauma and plays an important role in the human psyche. In an interview, which is now available under the name Jung on Film, Richard I. Evans asked Jung what he thought about the theory of his colleague Otto Rank attributing psychological significance to the trauma of birth. Jung laughingly dismissed this idea. "Oh, birth is not a trauma, it is a fact. Everybody is born." Jung's most fundamental contribution to psychotherapy is his recognition of the spiritual dimensions of the psyche and his discoveries in the transpersonal realms. Observations from holotropic states have brought strong support for the existence of the collective unconscious and the archetypal world. Jung's understanding of the nature of libido, his distinction between the ego and the self, the recognition of the creative and prospective function of the unconscious, and the concept of the individuation process. All of these elements can be independently confirmed by observations in psychedelic and holotropic breathwork sessions, even with unsophisticated subjects. Material of this kind also frequently emerges in sessions guided by therapists who are not Jungians, and even those who have no knowledge of Jungian psychology. In a more specific way, analytical psychology is very useful in understanding various archetypal images and themes that surface spontaneously in experiential sessions. Deep experiential work has also independently confirmed Jung's observations on the significance of synchronicity. The differences between the concepts presented in this encyclopedia and Jung's theories are relatively minor as compared to the far-reaching correlations. It has already been mentioned that the concept of the coax system is similar, but not identical to Jung's description of a psychological complex. Jungian psychology has a good, general understanding of the process of psycho-spiritual death-rebirth as an archetypal theme, but does not recognize the perinatal level of the unconscious and the importance of the trauma of birth. Perinatal phenomena, with their emphasis on birth and death, represent a critical interface between individual biography and the transpersonal realms. Deep experiential confrontation with this level of the psyche is typically associated with the sense of a serious threat to survival and with a life-death struggle. Death-rebirth experiences have an important biological dimension. They are often accompanied by a broad spectrum of intense physiological manifestations, such as feelings of suffocation, pain in different parts of the body, tremors, cardiovascular distress, hypersalivation, sweating, nausea and vomiting, and on rare occasions, unintentional urination. In Jungian analysis, which uses more subtle techniques than psychedelic therapy or some of the new powerful experiential approaches, the emphasis is on the psychological, philosophical, and spiritual dimensions of the death-rebirth process, while the psychosomatic components are seldom, if ever, effectively dealt with. In experiential psychotherapy, one always encounters an amalgam of actual fetal memories of biological birth and concomitant themes from the archetypal and historical collective unconscious. Swiss psychologist Arnie Mindell and his wife Amy have introduced the missing somatic elements into Jungian analysis by developing what they call process psychotherapy. In the transpersonal realm, Jungian psychology seems to have explored certain categories of experiences in considerable detail, while entirely neglecting others. The areas that have been discovered and thoroughly studied by Jung and his followers include the dynamics of the archetypes and the collective unconscious, mythopoetic properties of the psyche, certain types of psychic phenomena, and synchronistic links between psychological processes and the world of matter. There seem to be no references, however, to transpersonal experiences that involve authentic identification with other people, animals, plants, and inorganic processes that can mediate access to new information about these elements of the material world. Considering Jung's deep interest and scholarship in the Eastern spiritual philosophies, it is surprising that he seemed to pay very little attention to past incarnation memories, which are of critical importance in any form of deep experiential psychotherapy. Despite the above differences, Jungians seem, in general, to be the most conceptually equipped to deal with the phenomenology of holotropic states of consciousness, provided they can get used to the dramatic form the experiences take and become comfortable with them. Knowledge of Jungian psychology and mythology is essential for safe and rewarding psychonautics. Sándor Ferenczi. It seems appropriate to conclude this brief journey through the world of depth psychology by mentioning the work of another prominent pioneer and member of Freud's Viennese circle, Sándor Ferenczi. Although he is not usually listed among the renegades, his original speculations and practices took him far beyond orthodox psychoanalysis. In his famous paper, The Confusion of the Tongues Between the Adults and the Child, Ferenczi returned to Freud's original idea that real incest plays an important role in the genesis of psychoneurosis, not the child's incest fantasy. Another of his controversial contributions to psychoanalysis was his concept of mutual analysis that he conducted with his American patients Elizabeth Severn and Clara Thompson. Also, his support of Otto Rank clearly indicated that he was far from a conforming and docile follower of Freud. In his theoretical framework, he seriously considered not only perinatal and prenatal events, but also phylogenetic memories. Being one of the few disciples of Freud who immediately accepted his concept of thanatos, Ferenczi also integrated a metaphysical analysis of death into his conceptual system. In his remarkable essay, Thalassa, A Theory of Genitality, Ferenczi described the sexual drive as an attempt to return to the maternal womb and even beyond it. According to him, in sexual intercourse, the interacting organisms share in the gratification of the germ cells. Men have the privilege of returning to the womb directly, while women entertain fantasy substitutes or identify with their children when they are pregnant. However, the essence of Ferenczi's Thalassa regressive trend is the striving to return to an even earlier situation, the original aquatic existence in the primeval ocean. In the last analysis, the amniotic fluid represents the water of the ocean filling a cavity in the maternal womb. According to Ferenczi, terrestrial mammals have a deep organismic craving to reverse the decision they once made when they left their oceanic milieu and return where they came from. This would be the solution the ancestors of today's whales and dolphins actually made millions of years ago. However, the ultimate goal of all life might be to arrive at a state characterized by the absence of irritability, and finally, to attain the inertia of the inorganic world. It is thus possible that death and dying are not absolute, and that germs of life and regressive tendencies lie hidden even within inorganic matter. One could then conceive of the entire organic and inorganic world as a system of perpetual oscillations between the will to live and the will to die, in which an absolute hegemony on the part of either life or death is never attained. Ferenczi thus clearly came close to the concepts of perennial philosophy and mysticism, although his formulations were expressed in the language of the natural sciences. This historical review of the conceptual disagreements in the early psychoanalytic movement clearly demonstrates that many of the concepts which may appear surprisingly new in Western psychology were, in one form or another, seriously considered and passionately discussed by the early pioneers of psychoanalysis. The major contribution of this review is thus an evaluation of the various schools of depth psychology in light of the findings of modern consciousness research, as well as the integration of their contributions into a comprehensive cartography of the psyche that will serve the needs of psychonauts.